KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. New Mexico U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan visited many communities in southern New Mexico this week, and he also paid a visit to an immigrant detention facility at Fort Bliss. I talked with Lujan about that experience and the senator's hopes for immigration reform, among many other issues. Senator, I know you've been visiting areas in southern New Mexico. Tell me about the trip.
Well, I always appreciate getting a chance to hear directly from constituents and community leaders throughout New Mexico, Fred. And this trip across southern New Mexico, I've had the honor of just meeting the mayors from Las Cruces and Mesilla, Sunland Park, Anthony and Deming, to not only talk about the American Rescue Plan and relief for southern New Mexico, but the importance of infrastructure in their communities as well, and very much appreciated what they shared with me and the leadership that they have shown, especially during these tough times in our communities. I also had the honor of visiting with community leaders and the mayor out in Alamogordo, New Mexico, had a chance to visit Flintinger Theater and the work that they are doing, and hopeful that they will qualify for some programs from Save Our Stages, which is part of the American Rescue Plan, to be able to help not just small businesses, but especially places that entertain us and that protect arts and culture. And then I had a very emotional visit out to Fort Bliss to go and visit with some of the unaccompanied children firsthand, to hear from Health and Human Service physicians and experts, the leaders from Fort Bliss themselves, and just seeing the work that is being done to provide humanitarian care to unaccompanied children. And it's definitely been an improvement from what I saw under President Donald Trump. There's still more work to do to always improve. But to see these students now have access to mental and behavioral health counselors, appreciate the food that they now have access to as well, where when we had a visit out to one of the detention facilities under President Trump, we sadly saw that these young unaccompanied kids, they were given frozen bean burritos and granola bars, and today saw that children were being served, at least for breakfast, it was scrambled eggs and, you know, papas, chopped up potatoes and beans and rice and tortillas. And also fruit, bananas and apples and oranges, and getting a chance to visit with some of these young men and young women and learning about why they fled some of the most violent parts of the world. And it's really because they were fearful for their lives and their own personal security. And it was either stay and get killed or raped or flee on this journey thousands of miles.
I know this is an issue you're very passionate about, to not only address the issue with asylum seekers and refugees who are trying to come to the United States, but to also look for some kind of comprehensive immigration reform that has evaded passage so far in Congress after many years of trying. What are your thoughts? I mean, thoughts on this. Is this possible, do you think, now with Democratic control of the House and the Senate and a Democratic president?
Well, remember, we still need 10 Republican senators to join us. Mm-hmm. And there are many Republican senators who are still in office that either voted for the comprehensive immigration reform package back in 2013. There are many others that have been elected that have said that they do support aspects of comprehensive immigration reform, including co-sponsors of the DREAM Act, others that have been very active in positive policies when they were leaders at the state level. So I'm still optimistic that we can find a path to earning support from our colleagues. Now, if that is not the case, I think every tool needs to be on the table to see how we can pass immigration reform, and there are several tools that are out there. The Dream and Promise Act have already passed the House of Representatives bipartisanly. The Farm Worker Modernization Act, passed the House of Representatives, with 30 Republicans voting for that package this year, 34 in the previous Congress. So clearly there's a bipartisan path to getting this done. And also making sure that the United States, that we're doing our part to stop the cause of migration from these parts of the country, with the Northern Triangle, where, you know, the corruption and the crime and the threats of violence to these young people. And that's going to be something that we have to do. And we're going to have to take leadership roles in as United States of America.
You know, you've already mentioned, I want to get to another issue before we run out of time, Senator, the fact that President Biden, in addition to supporting immigration reform, is supporting a major infrastructure plan that no one argues is against the need for much of what's in that plan. But Republicans are balking on the cost of it. Even some Democrats may be on the fence, it appears. Tell me your thoughts on how this can get passed in some form in the Senate.
Well, so I'm reaching out to you and doing this interview from La Clinica here in Las Cruces today as we talk about the importance of infrastructure. And this is an example where the city of Las Cruces partnered with La Clinica. It was a hospital that was built and retrofitted, and there are now essential services that are being provided to the community with primary health care, dental care, mental and behavioral health care. This is infrastructure, and there's every community in America needs water, wastewater improvements. Every community in America needs access to fast, affordable internet access. Every community in America needs infrastructure, and that this is something that I just don't understand why there's reluctance from so many of my Republican colleagues to work together on a comprehensive immigration package. I'm still hopeful that not only will we see a bipartisan package passed with 60 votes in the Senate and also a majority of votes out of the House. And then here's the last thing on this, Jeff. Infrastructure and the American Jobs Plan is a popular package among the American people. Public sentiment is there. And so I think that our Republican colleagues have a real challenge if they're going to go home to their communities and say that they didn't support better roads and bridges, better water and wastewater infrastructure, building out broadband in communities, making sure that we're modernizing the transmission grid and distribution when it comes to the delivery of power in our communities as well. So, Fred, I very much appreciate that and see what more we can be doing in every one of these communities.
Absolutely. Well, one final question for you as we're running out of time here. As you know, the House has approved the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. Some in Congress, including your colleague, Senator Amy Klobuchar, saying that this should be able to find the votes in the Senate. What are your thoughts on this bill and its chances?
I'm very optimistic to the bipartisan talks that are still taking place with Congresswoman Karen Bass of California, and also Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, the Majority Whip, and Tim Scott, U.S. Senator of South Carolina. Tim, as you know, authored a piece of legislation in the last Congress. I voted for the legislation that passed out of the House of Representatives when I was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. And I also agree with the assessment that you just laid out, Fred, that there is a path to being able to secure the votes for a package like this. But I'm also optimistic that there are bipartisan talks taking place. And look, I've never underestimated Karen Bass. She's a very effective leader. And if there's anyone that can bring people together, it's her.
Senator Ben Ray Lujan, it is always a pleasure. Thank you for being with us.
Fred, thank you so much, and I always look forward to visiting with you.
Senator Ben Ray Lujan, if you're just joining us, the senator was in southern New Mexico this week, touring throughout the area, and he also visited Fort Bliss. The senator also says that he thinks there is a path to a compromise for passage of President Biden's infrastructure legislation and the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. You can listen to this full interview again online at krwg.org.
ICE officials have started vaccinating some immigrants in a Houston detention center. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has been following this story very closely, and she reports for us now that hundreds of people in similar facilities are sick with COVID-19, and this facility may be the first in Texas to administer vaccines.
Houston's health department sent 130 first doses of the Moderna vaccine to ICE's Houston Processing Center in North Houston. The city's Immunization Bureau Chief Omar Salgado says the request came in through the state of Texas, and they expect to give second doses in coming weeks.
We just want to make sure those folks are vaccinated, protected, so when they are released, they can go back and also protect their family, because we don't want to spread. We don't want an outbreak inside the facility.
This is the first time ICE has received COVID vaccines from the city of Houston. Six immigration attorneys told us this is the first known coronavirus vaccination effort inside ICE detention centers in Texas. Some 400 people are under isolation for COVID-19 in Texas ICE facilities. I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
A commentary about border policy now. Some argue that symbolism, not security, is the reason for the border wall, including commentator Walt Rubel.
For the past 4 years, our nation's immigration policy was the equivalent of a keep out sign on the front yard. That didn't stop desperate migrants from seeking refuge. The border wall was the physical embodiment of that policy. It was the top priority for the previous administration and the most motivating issue for the Republican base, who were promised that Mexico would pay for it. Former President Donald Trump routinely battled with members of Congress, including those from his own party, over funding for the wall. That dispute led to a 35-day government shutdown in 2018, the longest in our nation's history. Trump eventually gave up on budgeting new money and decided instead to divert money that had already been budgeted for other purposes. He took $3.6 billion intended for military projects throughout the world and funneled it all to the southern border. It's estimated that by the time he left office, Trump had spent $15 billion and completed some 380 miles of new barrier. None of that has been successful. Despite that massive investment, the Border Patrol has reported a record number of apprehensions at the southern border this year. There are more migrant children in federal shelters than ever before. Last week, new President Joe Biden pulled the plug on the whole operation. He announced that they would end all contracts for wall construction and return the money that had been diverted from the Defense Department. He also announced that they would spend some of the $1.4 billion appropriated for wall construction to repair environmental damage caused by that construction. It is, obviously, the height of wasteful spending to halt a project midway through. But this project never should have been started. The notion that we were going to build an impenetrable wall the length of the southern border to solve our immigration problem was always going to work better at campaign rallies than in reality. And the notion that we would bully Mexico into paying for a wall intended to keep their people out is absurd. The border wall was always more about symbolism than security. It was a message, not only to those in Mexico, but to all our southern neighbors, that America has become a gated community. Along with halting construction on the wall, Biden also ended the Remain in Mexico policy that had been imposed by Trump. That's led to a temporary crisis at the border, with more unaccompanied children flowing into the system than it can accommodate. The solution is not a wall, but rather investments in shelters that will allow unaccompanied children to be housed humanely, and in immigration courts that will allow for their cases to be resolved quickly. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
And if you ever miss Walt's commentaries, no worries, we have you covered. You'll find him in the local viewpoint section at krwg.org. His opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. This is KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. So great to be back with you after a week off. Hope you enjoyed the special last week got a lot of feedback about that. Such an important issue here and around the country, the crippling debts from student loans and what should be done about it. We'll have more of those fascinating debate specials coming up in the months ahead. Well, New Mexico is working to combat student learning losses during the pandemic. Officials are overseeing the allocation of $1.5 billion in special funding to address COVID impacts. Madison Staten has more.
Members of the New Mexico Legislative Finance Committee say more needs to be done to address learning losses during the pandemic. At a recent meeting, Representative Javier Martinez called on the legislature to find creative ways to re-engage lost students.
I'm concerned because I don't know that laptops or tutoring or sitting in school is going to re-engage any of those middle school to high school students. And I'm scared. If you look at the crime rate across the state, if you look at Albuquerque, these are 15, 16-year-olds that are out of the system, right? Completely out. I'm not sure we're going to get them back with laptops and extended school here.
So far, the majority of the state's pandemic-related expenditures have gone toward instructional purchases, like technology resources. But the increased investment has not been enough to keep all students engaged in the classroom. Last November, the New Mexico Public Education Department reported that approximately 12,000 students who had been enrolled in the spring of 2020 were unaccounted for during the fall semester. As of March, that number was reduced to about 2,500 missing students. And even for those in attendance, measuring learning loss has been a challenge, according to Deputy LFC Director John Courtney.
Parents are doing a really good job on these tests. There's a lot of parental help, it's thought, and there's some selection bias also in that a lot of the students that took the tests are students that aren't from low-income or at-risk backgrounds.
$1.5 billion from the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund has been allocated to schools, local educational agencies, and the New Mexico Public Education Department to address COVID impacts. While each district is required to submit a spending plan, Majority Floor Leader Cheryl Williams Stapleton says she worries funds could potentially be misappropriated.
Even when we send money to them, we say, appropriate this funding for this, this, and this. It never happens most of the time. Some do it right, some interpret it differently. How do we know the equality education to the children across the state of New Mexico is being sufficient and allocated correctly?
One safeguard cited is the stipulation that 20% of funding must go toward combating learning loss through extended educational opportunities. In April, the Las Cruces Public School Board unanimously voted against implementing an extended calendar for the 2021-2022 school year, despite the potential for additional funding. The board made the decision after listening to public comment and reviewing a community survey that indicated the majority of those who responded were against extending the calendar. School board member Teresa Tenorio says learning loss does need to be addressed, but she says a little extra time in the classroom won't solve the problem.
Going forward, I just don't understand how 30 extra minutes a day or 10 extra days where everything else is structured the same would benefit my kids or any kids in our district, because it's not working. It hasn't worked. We need to really try something different.
Tenorio says there are more beneficial ways for the district to help students, citing smaller class sizes as one example. A 2016 study by the National Education Policy Center at the University of Colorado found that reducing class sizes can improve learning outcomes. The research said this is especially important for populations most affected by large class sizes, like low-income and minority students. The report recommended class sizes between 15 and 18 people. While class size reduction can be expensive, the report said it could prove to be the most cost-effective policy in the long run. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
And Madison will be back with more education news coming up later in the show. It's a huge issue, not only for our region, but for the entire state of New Mexico, ensuring equity in education. Madison visited the Las Cruces School Board meeting this week. She'll have the latest on what that district is trying to do to improve equity in their district. Well, it looks like a member of the public will be flying into space soon. Sorry to tell you, though, it will not happen at Spaceport America. We're still waiting. The private space company Blue Origin says it will launch a flight from West Texas in late July with humans on board for the first time. Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik has more on the announcement from the company owned by billionaire Jeff Bezos.
The news of the flight, planned for July 20th, comes after years of rocket tests from the company's site north of Van Horn. Blue Origin's auctioning off one seat on the flight, but it hasn't said much yet about who else will be on board. The auction starts later this month and will benefit the company's foundation that encourages kids to pursue science and technology careers. Arian Cornell is the company's director of astronaut sales.
We will have other people as part of the crew. This is the only seat that is open for purchase, which is the, again, very first seat that's open to the public.
The 10-minute flight will take the crew up just inside the edge of space for a brief view of Earth before the crew capsule parachutes back down to near the launch site. I'm Travis Bubenik in Marfa.
What a story. It was supposed to be the worldwide headline from New Mexico, and it looks like it's going to be from Van Horn, Texas, just down the road. Travis Bubenik, by the way, we welcome him back. He hadn't heard him in a while because he was working in print journalism for a while. We're so glad he's back at Marfa Public Radio, and we'll hear more of his great reporting in the year ahead. Good to have you back, Travis. Well, researchers are still looking into the cause of migratory bird deaths last year. We have more on that now from the New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown.
Migratory birds are returning to New Mexico after a 2020 migration that resulted in a mass die-off. But wildfires due to climate change remain a serious threat to their survival. In August and September of last year, abnormally large numbers of birds turned up dead in people's backyards in New Mexico, Colorado, and other western states. Concerned residents documented the event on a crowdsourced science platform called iNaturalist. Annie Yang, studying the phenomenon as a postdoctoral fellow in spatial ecology at Colorado State University, wanted to know if wildfires across the West had an impact.
The wildfire and also the toxic gas and the smoke is major factors that will influence the spatial distribution of the birds' die-off events.
Yang notes while birds have adapted to wildfires, climate change has caused fires to burn hotter and larger than in previous centuries, making birds' respiratory systems more vulnerable. According to the data, more birds died in urban areas. But Yang says because the pandemic forced people to stay closer to home, they might have paid more attention to dead birds than people who live in rural areas. She says the study looked at deaths of multiple migratory species, including warblers, geese, hummingbirds, swallows, flycatchers, and sparrows.
If we have that every year, it will significantly impact the population structure and impact the population density of those migratory birds.
Yang says researchers also studied whether early winter storms in the West in 2020 played a role in the mass die-off about the same time. They found there was no strong correlation compared to wildfires and the toxic gases they produced. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Another environmental story now, and one that has implications for commerce. The United States has suspended the importation of wild-caught shrimp from Mexico. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, KJZZ's Murphy Woodhouse has that report.
In a State Department notice in the Federal Register, the agency said it, quote, suspended the certification of Mexico because its sea turtle protection program is no longer comparable to that of the United States. In response, Mexico's National Aquaculture and Fishing Commission said it would carry out preventive and corrective measures, including training and an aggressive inspection and enforcement effort.
Sí, yo creo que sí, ya sucedió una vez. Y esperamos que vuelva otra vez a...
Leon Tissot is the secretary of the Sonoran branch of the National Fishing Industry Chamber. He says such a ban has happened before, and he believes that the current one shouldn't take long to clear up. The ban does not apply to farmed shrimp, which accounts for the vast majority of Sonoran production, according to Tissot. I'm Murphy Woodhouse in Hermosillo.
To an environmental story now locally, one that we've been telling you about on KRWG News. The Las Cruces City Council this week adopted an ordinance to help prevent the contamination of the city's water supply through the removal of septic tanks. Such an important issue. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
A unanimously adopted ordinance will require hundreds of homes to move onto the city's sewer system, following an update to the municipal code by the Las Cruces City Council. The Water and Wastewater System Master Plan update, which has been in development since 2008, includes a plan to keep the Las Cruces water supply clean. Preventing water contamination from septic tanks was cited as the main reason for the code change. But the estimated $5,000 initial cost per property, one that homeowners will be responsible for, gave some city council members pause. Councilor Tessa Beda-Stuvey highlighted the burden placed on homeowners, saying the cost of switching from septic to sewer was a concern among her constituents.
This was one of the most talked about issues, and cost was brought up. And for a lot of these families as well, they were in a very middle zone, where they may not qualify for any of the assistance, but they don't necessarily have, or this could be the tipping point for them to have to give these types of costs.
Prior to the vote, councilors worked to ensure that both grant opportunities and payment plans would be available to homeowners. One proposed program designed to help offset costs is the CDBG Utility Upgrade Assistance Program, which would help to provide funding to low and moderate income households through grants. Housing and Neighborhood Services Manager Natalie Green went over how the program will help assist those in need.
It would fall under the umbrella of Home Rehabilitation Program, and they have anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000 a year to dedicate to home rehabilitation projects. We do operate this similar program with our gas utility for mobile homes. Staff is already planning a big overhaul of the home rehab program as a whole. But we would fund these projects again. We'd work with utilities to ensure that we had sufficient budget to cover this portion.
Assistant Utilities Director Adrian Widmer reviewed another funding tool, outlining what a five-year payment plan could potentially look like for homeowners.
Once the project is completed, where they have the 1 year to actually hook up, if they want to, they do the payment plan on the impact fee, and then they hire their plumber to do the rest of the work, which just means there's like $2,600, $2,700 that they don't have to fund right away.
Independent of the payment plan, homeowners will still be responsible for plumbing costs and decommissioning expenses for the original septic tank. The remaining expenses could potentially be funded by the assistance program. Councilor Ioana Bencomo says she will work to make sure homeowners impacted by the ordinance understand the funding options available to them.
Honestly, just from what I know about community engagement and people being involved in city government, that often folks who are low-income families, they're the ones that potentially are least engaged in city government, and not because of not caring, but because there's no time. And then in the areas that I at least know in District 4, that there may be a lot of actually low-income folks who might not even understand or have access to the information about financial support.
Those wondering if they will be impacted by the new ordinance can reach out to the city's utility department by going to the city's website. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Thanks for joining us on KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. It's so great to be with you. Stay in touch with the latest news from around the corner and across the globe anytime at the region's homepage, krwg.org. Well, President Joe Biden has asked Congress to invest in evidence-based job training programs, including funds for community college-based apprenticeship programs. As the New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports, experts say this is a good idea.
In Congress, members of both parties have expressed support for targeting funds for community college-based apprenticeship programs, typically used to train workers on the job, allowing a person to earn wages while also taking courses. Taylor White, National Director for the nonprofit group New America, says apprenticeships are no longer only for people in the construction trades, but for those who want to work in cybersecurity, business, or healthcare.
So apprenticeships has a really long history in this country and the world over of being the training option of choice for skilled trades. It's work you do with your hands, and so you need to learn that in a workplace setting where you're actually gaining experience doing the work.
I'm Roz Brown.
We move to another important labor issue now, and that's the working conditions for farm laborers. This is important nationally and really a focus in our area where agriculture is big business. La Semilla Food Center has been working on this in depth now. Anthony Moreno talked with the organization's co-executive director, Kristen Aguilar, to learn more.
Some in our community may be familiar because we have had a history of farm workers, braceros in our area, in our region, that go back decades. And so I'd like to hear from you, you know, what are some of the issues and challenges that farm workers in our country today are facing?
Yeah, absolutely. So most people might not know that farm workers aren't afforded a lot of the protections that any other worker is afforded. Things like minimum wage laws don't apply to them, workers' comp or insurance, paid time, right? Like all of these things that are focused on supporting our farm workers, they don't have those protections that most workers in our country have. And historically, right, the reason for that is because it was an agricultural system that was built on exploitation, right? And so we kind of changed it a little bit and tried to figure out, well, how can we keep doing this? But the point is, we can't keep doing this. It's not sustainable long term. How are we going to feed our community if part of our community can't feed themselves because they aren't getting paid enough to pick food, right? And so there's no easy answer to this. There is a big shift that has to happen, and it won't be smooth or easy, and it will be a little painful, right? Because because they're also farmers who have to make a living for their families. And how do we make that shift from paying our farmers what their food is worth, so that they can pay their workers what their work is worth, and still make sure that our families who are living in poverty are able to afford food? It's a very complex situation because we have a system that has been set up for generations that serves to create money and wealth for a very select few, but doesn't necessarily work in a very comprehensive way for the long term. You know, couple that with huge droughts that we're in right now, right? Like as our region, our country, and figuring out, well, what does that mean for our farming community long term? How are we going to keep farming on this land for the next 100 years? So there are big shifts that have to happen. There are no easy answers, but there are some answers, and there are ways forward to do that. You know, our food system is highly subsidized. Yeah. Some of our conventional food system is highly subsidized for commodity crops, but not for fruits and vegetables. And so if we're asking our small farmers or our farmers who are feeding our communities to compete with highly subsidized food systems, that's not quite fair either. So we have to like start putting all these different puzzle pieces together to really start making any change.
Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has put a lot of attention on essential workers and folks who work in agriculture and the food industry, as well as the whole setup of the food system that we have. Do you think that this is an opportunity to really address this issue now that so much attention has been paid to farm workers and folks who are called essential workers in this industry? And if so, what can be done, do you think, to where all sides can find some sort of agreement?
Right. So I think that a lot of us working in the food and farm system and organizing groups have always known, right, that there are these inequities, and the folks who are feeding us were getting left out of a lot of conversations. And like you said, COVID really brought to light all of these inequities. And so there are ways to move forward, and it is, you know, enacting a livable wage for all people. and is ensuring that subsidies for our farm systems are going to the fruits and vegetables and other foods that are like feeding our families and not just commodity crops. It's making sure that we're supporting our small farmers and mid-sized farmers as they're growing and trying to scale and feed our communities, and supporting agricultural workers so that they can make a living wage and have, you know, the basic protections afforded to most other workers.
That was La Semilla Food Center's co-executive director, Kristen Aguilar. The organization recently was awarded a grant from the Ford Foundation and the National Association of Latino Arts and Culture to fund a project that aims to change the narrative surrounding the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, speaking of narratives, we've been bringing you many of them about military life. The StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces in March of last year, and every week we've been presenting portions of those interviews. Today, World War II veteran Mario Kirker is interviewed by his friend David Morrison.
I was 17 years old. And I was working in a lumber yard for $14 a week. So I decided to join the Navy when I was 17. And I asked my mother, and she says, no, you are taking care of the family. And my father was very sick. He couldn't work anymore. So he says, if my son wants to go and fight for his country, I will sign for him tomorrow. The following days, we went to the recruiter, and I was sent to Santa Fe for a examination. And the two doctors were talking to each other, and I figured that they were talking about me. And I confronted the two doctors, and asked him, what's wrong? He said, you're lacking 1 pound. I said, let me tell you something. Nobody's going to deprive me of fighting for my country for just 1 pound, and the doctor makes a motion, you're in.
That's a great story.
I was sent to Fergus, Idaho for my training, and they sent us to Evansville, Indiana to pick a brand new ship, the LST-123. My duty was to take care of the power on the ship for 2 years, and I was a first gunner aboard the ship on the bow to fire at the first enemies. We knocked 2 planes down, and the last one was the most horrible thing you could ever see. A torpedo was dropped at our ship. Right close to us was another small ship, and he asked to advance, and when he advanced, he got in line of the torpedo and cut it in half, cut the other ship in half, and saved our ship that we carried 150 Marines with us.
Was this at Guadalcanal or was it at Guam?
It was before the invasion of Guam, and we were safe.
So you also wanted to sneak off and go on land, did for some reason. What can you tell me?
When we went into Guam, we started unloading. We were the first ones to go in, and they told us that we couldn't get off the ship and walk for both places, but don't go in too far because it was very dangerous. So I got off, and I decided to go and look for a Japanese wash. When I got close to the shore, I noticed rifles on the beach from east to west. As far as you could see, there were rifles all over the beach, and I believe that each rifle belongs to a Marine, and there were 2 tanks. One of them had a big round hole on it, and as I got close, I noticed a lot of humans were left. Nothing was left but just little pieces of human being. And then there was another tank right close to it, and there was a Marine standing on it, and he jumped from the tank and started running where I was coming, and he was my friend that I got to know. And then he came over and hugged me. He started crying, and then he gave me the bad news. He said, Kirker, out of 150, they killed my friends. 105 were killed, and we were only 45 left. And I cried, too. I cried with him. I cried, both of them. I cried. He said, Kirker, go back. It's too dangerous here. Go back and go back to the ship. Yeah.
So when you got back, Mario, what kind of job did you start doing?
Well, when I got back, I went to the local mine, Chino Mine Company in Hurley and Santa Rita. And then I started working there, and I said, well, what am I doing here as a laborer? I'm a diesel mechanic. And there was a big sign, diesel mechanics are needed. And I went in to the office, and the man that was there, I asked him if I could fill out an application. And he gave me, as soon as he saw me, he said, we don't have any openings. I said, well, I just got vet from the war. I fought in three major battles. And then he said, tough, bang, bang, that you had to go and fight. We don't know your bang, bang thing. I felt like crying because I saw my friends, young kids, young men like myself, left behind. They die. So I felt pretty bad. I quit the job there, and I went and got another job as a blacksmith. I learned how to be a blacksmith. I was a police officer for 35 years. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Thank you, Dave. I'm very grateful myself to have known them.
And since that interview, World War II veteran Mario Kirker celebrated his 95th birthday. To hear that segment as well as the full interview and much more, go to the StoryCorps page in the radio section at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes, more at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. This is KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. It is great to be with you. As promised, we return to education news now, and the Las Cruces Public Schools Board of Education met in a work session this week to review a previously adopted equity policy mandating a more inclusive curriculum. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Las Cruces School Board members stood by their decision to implement an LCPS policy designed to promote equity in the classroom amidst critical public comment. The policy, which was adopted in April, calls for additional curriculum to be created that takes into account both the home cultures and languages of students. During a second reading of the policy, School Board Member Maria Flores spoke about the impact it will have in the classroom.
It's not to learn to hate anyone. On the contrary, it is first and foremost a local thing that each class could be tailored to the students themselves. The students that are there are the ones that will dictate what they want to learn and only to learn about themselves and others. That is what ethnic studies is about.
Dulcinea Lara, an associate professor at New Mexico State University, has taught ethnic studies for 2 decades. She says that ethnic studies is about fostering a dialogue and exploring historically overlooked topics.
We don't see enough Native American, Mexican American, African American, or women. We don't see enough of these important folks in our history curriculum. I think that indoctrination by absence or erasure. And so with ethnic studies, we're trying to kind of balance out the curriculum.
Public criticism of the policy centered in part around targeting the specific cultures of students in a classroom setting, as public commenter Barbara Veer described to the board.
But who's going to be pointing the finger at who's who and who goes into what category? I think that's something that everybody should take a good look at. Because if you're going to start pointing the finger, I'm pointing it right back at you.
Isabella Solis, a former Doña Ana County Commissioner who previously ran for the New Mexico House of Representatives, spoke out against the policy during public comment, calling for a public hearing.
This is a major decision that's being made by a board, and you are talking about the future of our children and our next generation, and you must listen to your constituents.
While school board members emphasize the critical need to hear all perspectives,
They also reminded the public that the policy is a legal requirement to address learning discrepancies identified in the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit. The lawsuit against the state of New Mexico found that the state failed to provide a uniform education system that sufficiently met students' needs. School board member Terry Dahlman stressed the district must comply with the mandate.
We would be out of compliance as a state, as a district, and so it is high time that we address equity in our school system across the state.
NMSU Associate Professor Dulcinea Lara says improving the district's graduation rate is critical, as LCPS Hispanic students are 8% less likely to graduate than their Caucasian counterparts. She shared how an increased focus on ethnic studies can help with the student body's overall performance, specifically highlighting progress made in Tucson, Arizona, which she says mirrors demographics in Las Cruces.
Some of the benefits of grade 9 through 12 ethnic studies are a 1.4 points GPA increase, 21 days more of attendance on average, 40 to 50% increase in graduation rate, specifically in Tucson, specifically for Native American and Mexican American students. And the most impressive increases happen for STEM, for standardized tests.
The board is exploring forum ideas to help educate the community on the policy. A third reading will occur during the board's next work session, according to School Board President Ray Jaramillo, where he says the policy will continue to be refined.
I think that it's just been getting better and better, and I think that a lot of those things have come from everyone on all perspectives. We can all look at the same policy, and obviously we're bringing in different perspectives.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
In other news from the board meeting this week, the board voted unanimously to rename the Las Cruces Public Schools Administration Complex in honor of the late superintendent, Dr. Karen Trujillo, who was tragically killed this year when she was hit by a vehicle in her neighborhood. Well, on the Health Watch this week, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force has issued new recommendations on when you should screen for lung cancer. The age to begin screening has been lowered from 55 to 50. It also reduces the needed smoking history from 30 to 20 years. Dr. David Ballas with the Dallas County-based Parkland Hospital explained to KERA Sam Baker what warranted this big change.
The uptake of this screening has been historically very low. Maybe 10, 15% of people who were available to get this screening previously were getting it. People are maybe more familiar with, you know, having screening mammograms for breast cancer and colonoscopies for colon cancer and pap smears for cervical cancer. They're not as aware that we now have a screening test for lung cancer.
Was some of this maybe a reluctance to take the test for some reason, some fear maybe of what they might find, cost, what?
Lots of reasons. You know, access to care, knowledge that it was available, maybe the providers not being aggressive enough, you know, a little bit of all of the above. It's been wonderful that there's been, you know, so much publicity and interest and fundraising for breast cancer. But again, there just hasn't been, you know, the push and the interest in screening for lung cancer.
Tell me what your patients tell you when you bring this up.
Most of them, I think, are very excited to have it done, that they're concerned about the risk of lung cancer. And again, these are high-risk smokers. They know that they're at risk for lung cancer. And again, this is a very simple, quick, low-dose CT scan. It's 5 minutes. There's really very, you know, minimal risk to having the CT scan done. It's not invasive. There's really not many good reasons not to do the test.
Why did we move towards low-dose CT scans? The chest X-ray didn't do the job?
Exactly. CT scans are much, much better than a chest X-ray.
Better how?
A much better picture. A lot more detail.
Are the scans any better at catching lung cancer earlier?
Absolutely. That's the whole point of all this. If we wait until people present with symptoms, unfortunately, the disease is often very advanced, stage 3 or stage 4, and it's spread where it's very difficult to treat the lung cancer. The whole idea of this screening CT scans is early detection, catching the cancer before they have symptoms at, say, a stage 1 where it's easily treatable. It hasn't spread. The patient can have a simple surgery, remove the entire cancer, and be cured and not have to have all the complications of advanced cancer and the complications of that go with that, with all the treatments and all the mortality. So
determining when to begin screening, particularly based on a person's smoking history, this can get a bit complicated, can it?
The age is simple, and that's 50. Now, the pack years takes a little calculation. One needs to have smoked at least 20 pack years to figure out that. It's the number of pack years on average they've smoked over a year. So 20 pack years would be the equivalent of someone smoking a pack a day on average for 20 years. But you could also get there by smoking two packs a day for 10 years, for instance, or a half a pack a day for 40 years.
Are there other causes of lung cancer besides smoking?
Yes, people who are exposed to other chemicals or pollutants in our air, or secondhand smoke, or radiations could be involved. But again, the vast majority is related to smoking. That's where we need to put our efforts. That's where we need to screen. And the most important thing we need to do is smoking cessation. So the number one thing we can do to reduce the mortality from lung cancer is to get people to not start smoking in the first place and then to quit.
What do you think needs to happen to get more people screened?
Yep, I think we got to get the word out again to everyone. And then using the electronic medical record system, again, to remind providers, again, they, just like we do, to remind them to do flu shots and mammograms. You know, the providers may know, but they're busy. And so using reminders can be helpful to make sure everybody knows that they're a candidate and that they need to have a discussion with the patient. So that's important. That we can't just order the test. We need to have a discussion with the patients of the pluses and minuses, like anything else, so they can make an informed decision. But you know, in most cases, patients should and will agree to undergo the test.
Dr. Bayless, thank you for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me again. Great to see you again.
Our weekly Health Watch, you can also catch it every Tuesday morning at 6:45 during Morning Edition. We so appreciate KERA's Sam Baker and all of the great health reporters throughout our region. In fact, coming up on Tuesday, we are going to have a new in-depth report from the Mountain West News Bureau. They're going to be looking at a very important issue, and that's vaccine hesitancy. How can it be eliminated? Such an important issue. Of course, at the region's homepage, krwg.org, you will find links to register for the vaccine if you're a New Mexico resident 16 or older. You'll also find a link to get a free at-home COVID-19 test. Have a program note for you. I really want you to take some time out tomorrow morning. If you have not seen the documentary Ralph Willis Goddard, New Mexico's first broadcaster, you can watch it tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. You may know our call letters were chosen in his honor. Find out why tomorrow morning at 11 as you learn about Goddard's pioneering work in radio broadcasting. Then, coming up at 11:30 tomorrow morning on KRWG-TV, join us for Fronteras, A Changing America. Anthony Moreno talks with Fred Nathan, founder and executive director of Think New Mexico, who shares his thoughts on many issues facing the state, including the need for fair lending, financial literacy in schools, capital outlay transparency, and the state tax on Social Security, which was not eliminated in the latest legislative session. That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino, broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.